Hello, everyone, and welcome to Dogs Unknown. We are really looking forward to this episode. I think it's going to be a lot of fun because it's all about breeds and breed stereotypes. Everyone listening to this podcast probably can immediately name your favorite breed or breed of dog right away. And generally speaking, the reason they're your favorite has more to do with just how they look. And it's because you're drawn to a certain set of character traits or qualities that you feel that individuals of that breed possess. You have a positive stereotype for your chosen breed, and you probably have stereotypes for lots of other breeds too, both positive and negative. But today we just want to explore, are these breed stereotypes we hold really valid? Because the existing research on breed and behavior connections is really a mixed bag. You know, it tells us that some of our dogs' behavior is somewhat influenced by breed some of the time, but that there's also a huge amount of variability in behavior with any given breed. So the science is messy at best. We thought it would be fun to take a look at what we as dog behavior professionals who get to work with thousands of different dogs of all different breeds every year, what do we think? Do we stereotype dogs based on their breed? And spoiler alert, the answer is yes, we do. But today we are joined by Suze Cullinan, who is a certified behavior consultant and the owner of Instinct New Jersey and Philadelphia. Welcome, Suze. And Dresden Graf, who is the owner of Instinct Fort Worth and also a behavior consultant. And both have, I know, some strong breed favorites of their own. And so we're going to discuss, yes, the ways that we view some of the most popular breeds that we work with when it comes to their temperament and training and general care. So welcome to you both. Really excited to have you here.
Happy to be here.
Awesome. And we have, for people who are watching video, you can see that the life of a behavior consultant and an Instinct location owner is always busy. So both folks are joining from their cars because they're kind enough to squeeze this in amongst all of their other duties and activities. So yes, very grateful that you can still be here. So let's jump right in. What we thought we'd like to do is play a little game called Guess the Behavior and Training Issues for some of the most common breeds that we work with. Preface this by saying, we're just going to say it once, every dog is an individual. This is not a guarantee that if you have a dog of a certain breed that they will have these issues. But if you had an adult dog coming in for a consultation and the only piece of information that you had about them was their breed, and you had to take a guess at what the behavior and training issues were likely to be, again, based only on the dog's breed and the fact that they're an adult, what would you guess? So we're going to go through some of the most common breeds that we work with, and we're going to start off with German Shepherds.
Dun, dun, dun.
Reactivity to other dogs, to strangers, pulling on the leash, or fear behaviors.
And Brian?
German Shepherds. Definitely pulling on the leash. Mm-hmm. Pretty hard. They definitely bear down and can really pull. Leash reactivity, for sure, because we definitely see a lot of them. And we do see a lot that are leash reactive, but also can be playful with other dogs. So sometimes it can just be pure frustration and generally being opinionated and vocal about certain things. So I think a lot of people come in and they have a lot to say. So I think those would be the three for me.
Yes. I think I would agree with all of those. Absolutely. The leash pulling, absolutely the reactivity towards other dogs, some level sometimes of suspicion or reactivity yes. around certain types of people. And yes, the screamy behavior, 100% frustration related barking and yelling and vocalizing is something we always know. And I love them to death. They're actually one of my favorite breeds, but we always know when we have a German Shepherd visiting us in the kennel. Our kennel is so quiet, but in moments where dogs would vocalize, you hear that signature machine gun, like pop, 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 pop. And yes. You're like, oh, there's a shepherd here today.
Yes. Or when we have the German Shepherds who are excited to come to Instinct to board or daycare, you can sometimes hear them coming from like a half a block away.
Wow, 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 wow.
Yeah, 100%.
That's a terrible impersonation, but
that's
yes.
pretty good.
So I think we're all on similar pages there. It feels like, and so everyone knows, you know, there's some overlap, I think, in all of our environments, but they're also quite different, which is nice. You know, Brian and I are working with dogs in pretty urban environments in the middle of Manhattan and New York City. Suze, you get a mix, I would say, of sort of urban and suburban dogs. And Dresden, fair to say, more suburban for you? Yeah. So it's nice to see. I'm always curious what part of this is environment and what part seems to be a trend with breeds. So with German Shepherds, we talked about the issues they're likely to have. What aspects of their personalities, in your stereotyped view, do you really enjoy? And what are you mindful of when it comes to training them? So like, what types of motivators are you likely to choose? Or, you know, what are you likely to maybe avoid as a teaching tactic when you're first getting to know this individual? So what do you love about them? And what's top of mind when you're training them? Dresden, you want to start this time?
Sure. Top of mind when training. This is kind of where that individual piece really comes in mind. I, as a behavior consultant, tend to see them fall on one way or the other, as far as being kind of that suspicious, fearful, or really low tolerance for frustration. So really fast moving, ready to go, or the don't move too fast, don't look at me, don't breathe wrong, tend to be the two sides that I see most of the shepherds that I get to see fall on. So my priority is always that clarity of communication, first and foremost, no matter which kind of branch of behavior I'm dealing with, whether they are really fearful or whether they do get frustrated really easily, that, again, laying that groundwork of this is what you can expect me to do and this is when you can expect me to do it tends to be one of the most important elements that I have in my training plans for shepherds. And then I personally have a shepherd mix. I love them. I love that they're chatty. He is hilarious. He's always telling me stories. He's always ready to work and he's always up for like whatever. So if we're going for, you know, a 6-mile hike, sure. If we're staying home and just, you know, watching squirrels in the yard and curling up with a book, he's like, oh, okay, that's come to him easier in his older age. But yeah, no, he's a riot.
Awesome. Cool. And do you mind if I go next, Brian?
Yeah, you can go first.
Awesome.
Otherwise, okay. Yeah.
So I think I absolutely love the partnership sort of dynamic that you can form with a shepherd and how strong you can make that connection. The social aspect for me, I find them really cool in terms of like, I feel like they can sometimes also be kind of intrinsically reinforced by the act of doing something together. And I really love that part of them. When I'm thinking about training them, I think oftentimes as a reinforcer, shepherds really love toy play. So I may go with that versus just food. With food, I find sometimes them really awkward about taking food from your hand. And I don't know if that's just because they have a really long snout and they're not very good at it. They do figure it out, but I tend to maybe toss food or offer food a little bit differently. Definitely work with these guys on helping them understand what leash pressure means so that it's less frustrating for them when they feel it, but also getting rid of that pressure as much as we can. So I find with shepherds, I'm really quick to jump to like a longer leash when I can, so that I'm removing one of those key sources of frustration where possible. And then I do find with shepherds, I find personally, if I'm working through behavior issues, they're a breed who tends to do really well with giving some nice clear direction and teaching specific skills to do in certain scenarios versus just a straight up, more straight up classical conditioning approach where we're just sort of feeding them and trying to change an emotional response. It's like a, let's do this specific activity while we're learning to feel more relaxed and better about the situation. So that's my take on shepherds.
Yeah, I would echo that. I do find them very tactile as well. Mm-hmm. It's one of the other reasons why I like working with them. Like I do feel like with them, you know, meeting a German Shepherd for the first time or working with them for the first time, I find it's really important to again, if they're comfortable with people and everything, like to invite them in, you know, give them deep pets, deep massages. And also just in terms of like giving them direction, they tend to be very tactile, which I really, really enjoy. Taking treats was definitely something I was going to say, like just, I don't.
For such like an athletic dog. Wow, they're so bad at taking food out of your hand.
Yeah, it's almost like they're drunk or something. I don't know. Like it's really awkward. So I would agree with that. Like a lot of them do. And again, I love working with them. I also like the social aspect with them as well. Like they're definitely not pushovers, and not that they should be pushing dogs over anyways, but they're not pushovers. They do have their own feelings. They can be a little independent, but also you can build a really nice relationship with them. And I think consistency, like if you can be consistent with them, you can have a really, really amazing relationship they're just a really cool dog. Like they, I do feel like that bond you can build with a German Shepherd is just really, really special.
100%.
And they just look badass. Like I love how German Shepherds
they
look.
They have like a total 80s vibe with like the jean yep. jacket and the shades, like the Ray-Bans maybe.
Yeah. And they like fly like a fighter. They're like a fighter pilot almost in my head. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So I love that. Thank you so much. I'm sure I would love to hear how German Shepherd owners agree or disagree with what we're saying. So moving along, unless anyone has final thoughts on Shepherds, moving along. So the next one that we're going to do is Doodles, specifically yeah. Labradoodles or Golden Doodles. And so we're going to start again with if you had to guess the behavior and training issues, what would you guess? Brian, you want to start?
Sure. So we get a lot of doodles and like just a lot of doodles. They're very popular right now. So lots and lots of experience with doodles. I would say for doodles, the behavior issues that I would be likely to see, separation anxiety comes top of mind. Sort of like a hyper attachment with the owner or sort of sometimes, I don't know if I want to use the word unhealthy or
insecure,
like insecure attachment style for sure. And I think those are probably the two biggest ones. And then sometimes too, there can be some, I feel like some conflict aggression, like some like resource guarding type behaviors as well.
Thank you for sharing that. Who wants to go next?
I definitely see a lot of the hyperactivity, the leash reactivity, the separation anxiety, and also more recently, I've seen more of the resource guarding coming in more frequently on my list as well.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think the only thing I would also add there is I think we see a lot of doodles who tend to struggle with a ton of overexcitement and greetings with their owners, but also just with guests in general. So lots of like really, really high levels of excitement and greeting. But the separation anxiety for me is absolutely the biggest one, along with that sort of stemming from like a what feels like an insecure attachment. Like they love really hard. And sometimes it takes some work to help them feel more confident about their attachment with their owner, regardless of the owner's behavior. I think they just sort of can tend toward that type of attachment. So, but what do we love about them? What do we love about doodles? I can share.
Yeah.
I think they're like bouncy and have like an incredible zest for life. I do agree with, I think Sue's mentioned that some of them are very skilled players with other dogs and can match up really well as well with like a pity or a more sort of a gregarious player or with like a softer style dog as well. I do find some of them to be quite adaptable in terms of their play style and super smart, but sometimes that's not a good thing. But I do find them super sharp in training, like really motivated to learn. But I think that kind of zest for life piece for me is like, it's just cool. You know, they're generally like pretty happy and bubbly about being alive, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what basically I was going to say as well. It's just that I was going to use the term zest for life as well. It's, there's never a boring day with a doodle. Let's put it that way. So there's lots of good mischief that they get into. There's, yeah, they just take it a day at a time and they will make your life interesting in lots of good ways. So I love them for that reason.
Yeah. And I would say training wise with doodles, I think it's this interesting mix of like, I'm really mindful of not accidentally reinforcing some of those more excited, almost bordering on frantic, yes. like offering of behaviors and focusing a lot on some really calm relaxation work. But mm-hmm. then also at the same time, making sure if I'm teaching skills, I am making training really fun and playing into that natural drive to do things. It's like a fine line to walk, I find, because they're so enthusiastic about doing things. It's easy to actually create this dog who's like, what now, what now, what now, what now, what now, what now, what now.
Yeah. You know? And I would also add too, I think one thing I've noticed with doodle puppies is they're so stinking cute that everybody wants to come up and touch them and pet them and do it. And sometimes there's puppies where like they don't want to greet every single person. And so just because they are so cute, they attract a lot of attention. I think it's really important for doodle owners, especially with puppies, to sort of be their advocate and create space for them when they need to. So like a healthy dose of socialization is always going to be good. but I almost feel like they can get overwhelmed sometimes as a puppy, and that can create issues later on where they're like, hey, people don't leave me alone, so I have to be a little bit more proactive about that.
I love that one. I do feel like sometimes that's where we see some of those handling issues stem from. And they learn pretty early on, because again, they are really sharp dogs, I find, like very super intelligent, that they're like, hey, if I use my teeth to get this person to go away, it won't stop touching me. You know, that seems to be effective, those sharp, needly puppy teeth. But yes, because they're so like these little fried chicken puppies. They're just so cute and everyone wants to touch them.
Yep.
Yeah. I love that you brought that up. Yeah. I think that makes sense. Anyone else have thoughts to add on doodles, or did we capture most of that?
Well, I love that you phrased it as they love big. And I think that really does encapsulate the doodle, is that they love life. They love people. They love doing things. In training, I do find that I do put a big emphasis on that calm and steady and bounce between a lot of activities. So, you know, having quite a few things that we're training at the same time, but doing a couple reps and then moving on and doing a couple reps and moving on, because they are so wicked smart and they like to do stuff. Yeah, just kind of keeping it moving, but making sure we add in those stops of, and sometimes the trick is just to wait. That is really important.
I also love that you use the term wicked smart for all the doodle owners living in Boston, because we definitely have people who follow this podcast in Boston. So hope there's some doodle owners there.
100%. Yes. Good. Love that. So yes, that's a nod to our doodle stereotypes. It feels like so far there's a lot of overlap between our shared experiences. I'm curious to see, as we get more into it, where there will be differences. So next on the list, suspenseful pause, is Shiba Inus.
Oh, yes. My favorite.
Well, since you're really excited, Brian, would you like to start?
Please.
Okay. So behavior-ish and training issues folks are likely to come in with. That one first.
Okay. God, my brain is just so focused on what I love about them. I'm almost blind to any of the issues that they come in with. This is top of my list for a future breed. So whether it's, you know, getting a puppy or going through a rescue, they're so on top of my list because.
And I support that decision. Yeah. 100%. All
right. So I'll hold off on the good stuff. I will say, I do think there can be resource guarding issues sometimes with the Shiba Inus, at least the ones that I've worked with. Also, handling issues as well. And that might also fall in the same category as the doodles, where they're so stinking cute. I do feel like they get like handled a lot all the time. They can be leash reactive as well. So I would say like those are probably the three that I feel like I sort of see. But definitely my last few cases of Shiba Inus, there's definitely resource guarding, handling issues, and leash reactivity. Because I've had a few Shibas recently, and it was sort of like those are like the top of my mind right now.
Mm, interesting.
Yep.
Suze, how about you?
So I will confess that I struggle with Shibas. So the things when I see a Shiba, I know I'm the polar opposite of you and Brian. So what comes to mind when I see a Shiba on the calendar? Definitely guarding. And of course, our view is colored because we don't see all the Shibas that are terrific, right? We see the ones who are struggling. So guarding, handling issues. We also see a fair number of Shibas, and the people come in because it feels like the Shiba is fighting without warning at all. And what I love about the Shibas is that they are sort of reserved and stoic, but they do have this playful streak. When you find it, it's a blast. And I do think they give body language signals, but those can be fleeting and subtle. So for a lot of first-time Shiba owners, it's helping them understand, you know, how to tap into the playfulness and how to recognize when they're uncomfortable.
I love that. It's like, for as big as the doodle emotions and expressions are, the Shiba is like the flip side of that. So learning how to really listen and understand them. I love that you brought that up.
Yeah. And it's interesting you bring that up, Suze, because then when I think about my last few Shibas and there was like the handling and resource issues that actually came up, was about how subtle that body language is. Mm-hmm. So I'm really glad you talked about that, because you are, I think you really hit the nail on the head with that one.
Yeah. And I think I would say if I think about Shibas and sort of their issues, I do feel like a lot of it tends to stem from them maybe just having a bigger personal space bubble or a different level of comfort with contact than a lot of other like typical classic breeds, like classic pet dog breeds have. So that when we talk about handling issues, I feel like it's more so just stems from, again, like they're more likely to find that stuff offensive and to maybe not have been listened to early on. I think even with some of the, I do find them to be dog selective, some of them. I find that if there's leash reactivity, it's again, more so because they've been in situations where maybe an owner has done a ton of on-leash greetings or let other dogs come up to them a lot. Like I find most Shibas perfectly content to mind their own business and pass by other dogs or other, you know, stimuli. It's just if they've had that bigger personal space bubble invaded over and over again, then they can get to a place of leash reactivity.
Yeah.
But I think that's what comes to mind for me. Dresden, are you, anything standing out as different for you for your Fort Worth Shibas?
We actually do not see a lot of Shibas down here at the Fort Worth location. I find that at least right now, most of the people who have Shibas tend to do a lot of research and really make sure that they want a Shiba before they get one. So, you know, that more aloof kind of personality. But when they do come across my board, it is almost always for handling or resource guarding.
When you were talking, something struck me, and I actually hadn't thought about it in this frame until now. You know, when I work with Shibas, even things like close proximity, just me existing close to them, it's almost as if we're doing cooperative care work, but for day-to-day living. And so what you were seeing about them, they have a bigger space bubble. I think that just really resonates.
Yeah. So I know, Suze, you already shared a little bit of what you love about them, which rings totally true, but we'll hear again. So what do we love about Shibas and what do we keep in mind when we're training them in terms of, you know, reinforcers or things we avoid?
Yeah.
Brian's like biting his tongue. You can go ahead.
Okay. Well, Shibas are way cooler than I'm ever going to be. Like I just feel like
they're way cooler than any of us are ever going to be.
Yeah. And they walk around with like, yeah, I feel like they walk around with like cool sunglasses and I sort of picture them as like this really kind of hip musician that's like walking around. And I really like them because they sort of give you like that. They're not really looking for, I feel like they're not looking for a traditional leader that we kind of think about in terms of dog training. They're sort of, it feels more like a, you know, cooperative, I don't even know cooperative is the right word. It's like you're in this life together. And I think with them, it's really important for them to realize that like you're on their side. And we're going through life together as opposed to like, you know, I'm going to be giving you a whole bunch of direction and sort of looking out for you. Like, I don't get that vibe from them. It's just sort of like, hey, I'm here to kind of help shepherd you through the world and make sure that's comfortable. And I feel like with Shibas, you kind of have to earn that. I always want to be careful with the word respect because I'm not talking about the way people think about respect in sort of traditional dog training. I just mean more like, are they going to be likely to take your input?
Humans don't assume, or Shiba, I shouldn't say this. I find that Shibas don't assume that all humans are competent.
Right.
Where some breeds do, right? Like some breeds just give you the benefit of the doubt that you're a human and you must know what's going on. And Shibas are like, you prove it to me.
Yes. And I love that. Yeah. Like, I absolutely love that. Like I started out, like I have to earn all of that. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, I just find that really cool. And I think it's just because they're so unique. They are totally comfortable just being a Shiba and being a dog. And they know we're humans and they can have awesome relationships. But yeah, I really do feel like it has to be earned. And I find every Shiba sort of unique in that way. And sort of how you partner with them in life is like really, really cool. So I absolutely love that. I love the way that they play as well.
Suze, you mentioned that when you unlock that like playful part of them, it's the best.
It's the best. And scritching them.
I love how you're describing Shibas as they don't automatically assume because you're the human, you know what you're doing. And that in a positive sense is really the best description. What you guys are just talking about are Shibas.
Yeah. Yeah. And I absolutely love scritching them. The ones who like it kind of like down by their butt and their tail, like, I love doing how they sort of like lean into you and do that.
Like a bear scratching their butt on a tree.
Yeah. Yeah. So I just find them very special and I really hope I have one someday. So I'll leave it at that.
I love all of that. What do we, I could add to all of that, but I think it's a lot of what folks have already said. So what do we keep in mind when we're training Shibas in terms of sort of, you know, motivators or things that we're mindful of? Anyone want to jump in?
So I'm not sure I can describe this well, but I feel like with Shibas, you never want to keep repeating a cue to a dog, but that's like a hard no for a Shiba. You know, to anthropomorphize it, they're like, I heard you. I'm thinking about it, you know. So the quieter of a handler I am with them, the better.
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's very well said. I think there's some breeds who find the activity of performing those skills very reinforcing in and of itself sometimes. And Shibas, I feel like, are less likely to be in that camp. So it's more just about, really, I do find with them, it's about like life skills. And you use certain cues when you need them. But otherwise, it's just kind of like, how do we coexist and move through this world peacefully together? And like, oh, let me show you where your mat is. Let me show you where your bones are. Would you like to go for a walk today, sir? Like, you know, it really is, less about that repetition. I feel 100%, Suze, I would agree with.
Yeah. And I'll also just kind of reiterate what Sue says. Like, I feel like you have to be so proactive about creating space for them. Mm-hmm. So both like around, and when you mentioned about leash reactivity, sometimes like they're, I don't think they're leash reactive out of the gate. It's like when they have their space mm-hmm. invaded a lot, then they're like, okay, I'll take this into my own hands and be proactive and scream at dogs who come near me. Yeah.
It seems like their default is I'm happy to mind my own business.
Yes.
But if everyone else isn't able to mind their own business, I'll take matters into my own hands and just sort of create some space for myself because it's important to me.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. And they don't really seem to have an issue going down that path, but I don't think it's their first choice for a lot of them.
I would agree with that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good. I love that. Well, that was a little bit of a love fest.
Yeah.
But I just love hearing the overlap, but also maybe the little points of difference. So next on the list, I'm trying to choose randomly here. Okay. We're going with pitties.
Yeah.
Pit bulls. We all work, I know, with so many. Brian and I have pity mixes. Suze, I know you do. Dresden, I know you work with a ton of them. I don't know if you have or have had one in your life personally. But I know like the experience we all have with them is, you know, pities are so common. So before we get into all the things that we love about them, what issues do you expect a pit bull to come in with? Dresden, you want to kick this one off?
I know I say it a lot, but again, leash reactivity and just that really intense leash reactivity to like the point where we think we're doing fine. Yeah. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah. I was going to say, I love that you started with that one because leash reactivity is obviously a super common issue across dogs, but clarifying like maybe the type of reactivity and what it stems from, like shepherds are frustrated. Shibas have their space invaded a lot. Like, what do you view in terms of pitties with that leash reactivity? I know you said the hyper explosive stuff, but like, where do you feel like a lot of times that, what's that rooted in for them kind of emotion wise? Put you on the spot a little bit there, but.
Again, you know, depends a lot on our background here. I do see a lot of the more frustration based mm-hmm. kind of explosive stuff because we do have a lot of opportunities down here in Texas where we have huge dog parks that are acres big where dogs do get to go and play quite a bit in big, you know, really appropriate spaces. So they do kind of latch on to that. I see dogs and I get to go, go, go and do this really tactile play. So I do see a lot of that kind of frustration based leash reactivity down here.
Cool. Suze, how about you?
So we all know I adore pitties, so I'll put that right out there. This is going to be one of my favorites. When I see them on the calendar, I think over arousal, jumping, mouthing, not biting, but mouthing. And I also joke they want to slam into you to say hello. So those are some of the things people, you know, they love their pitties, but it's like really could take it down a notch. So that's sort of how I think of pit bulls in general. Like you guys, I also have one, adore them. It's a lot, and you got to sort of be ready for that. It's very different than a more, I don't want to say pitiful, but some of the more pet home breeds that we see. I also wonder, quite frankly, that we do have a lot of pitties in New Jersey and Philadelphia, and unfortunately, a lot of them end up growing up in shelters and might get returned a time or two. So when I see a pity on the calendar, I'm always going to think about going back in their development and getting the impulse control and, you know, handler attentiveness, and that, yes, they are the world's biggest lapdog, but that's not always what's needed. So that's what we tend to work on that they might have missed if they were in the really good shelter system still, you know, they're going to need help there.
Yeah.
I love that because that speaks to environment too. Because if I think about most pities that we work with, I think I would say 90, I'm not exaggerating, like we've probably... There has to be close to 1,000 pities that we've worked with over the years. And the number that have come from breeders versus come from rescues, is like, it's almost all from rescues. It's very, very small that have come from breeders. And so like, we can't ignore that fact that like, if you're growing up in a shelter, been in and out of a shelter, like that can be traumatic, no matter how well run the shelter is. That's not to throw anything at a shelter rescue people. Everyone's doing their best and there's lots of good ones out there. But I think that's really important, especially when you pair that with, like you said, Dresden and Sue, I think that like really low frustration tolerance, really, they can get over aroused very easily. And you sort of combine that with sort of a lot of early life instability. Mm-hmm. I think it can lead to things like the leash reactivity and things that we're talking about. But yes, they're very prone to, like, because they have that high arousal, they love life. They're kind of like, you know, they kind of feel like a frat guy to me sometimes. Like they're just sort of a little like in your space a lot. That's why part of the reason why we love them and why we have them. So, but I did want to put that out there that I think I agree with, like the high arousal, the, you know, the low frustration tolerance. And I think coupled with a lot of them, I think have a lot of instability in their early life, like definitely plays into that.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I would say it's almost like our stereotypes of pities that we have are really our stereotypes of pities who've been through a shelter or rescue system.
Yeah.
Versus, because that's just the majority of who we've worked with, which I think is not the case with a lot of the other breeds that we've spoken about already. Right. So I think that is, I love that you called that out. I feel like, totally agree, like the proneness to sort of over arousal. Suze, I love that 100% those like over the top greetings that are accompanied sometimes by, they are like they're mouthy, you know, they're like, they like to put their teeth on things. They love to play tug and things like that, but that can come out in some over arousal and greetings as well. And certainly that more explosive type of reactivity. And then I do think we come across a fair number who are dog selective, right? Like they have certain profiles of friends who they can play with. And that's pretty common for adult dogs anyway. You know, but that is a recurring theme, I think, in some of the pities who come in, is they're a little bit more selective about who their dog friends are. Or sometimes just their play style, truthfully, is not acceptable to a lot of other breeds. And maybe that's where we're selective about who they play with and who's a good match.
Yeah.
Because that high level of arousal can get them in trouble.
Yeah, it can. And I do want to point out that like some of our best helper dogs in terms of like socializing with other dogs and being like a peacemaker and helping us with play groups and dogs learning have been pitties.
Yeah.
So I also want, again,
when they're good, they're fantastic.
When they're just amazing because they're able to handle a lot of different play styles. If they play... They tend to make, especially younger dogs, they can kind of influence their play style to be a lot more loud and guttural and those types of things. So they can't have that. But I do want to point out, I know we're not caveating every breed, but I do want to point out, just because we're all, I think, a little sensitive to this breed and stereotypes, that some of our best helper dogs have absolutely been pitties.
Yep.
And I would pay almost anything to have them back. Some of the ones who have passed away and passed on because they were just so incredible. Yep. So I wanted to throw that out there too.
For sure. And truthfully, for being fair, like I think most German Shepherds are dog selective and I think most Shibas are dog selective as well.
Exactly.
You know, so yeah. Okay. And then I think we've talked a little bit about what we love about pitties already, but maybe not extensively. So maybe we can go into that. Suze, let's start with you, because I know you're a huge fan. What makes your heart melt about pit bulls?
They really are snugglers, at least in my experience, both with the dogs I've trained and the pitties I've owned. And there's a sense of a clown in them too. They can get so silly. And to see this big, imposing, you know, big head just really wanting to play with their person is one of my favorite things about pitties.
Love that. Dresden, how about you? What do you love about them? And what do you keep in mind when you're training them?
I do love how much they love their people. And I do love how funny they are. I do enjoy humor in dogs quite a bit, obviously, since I've mentioned that a few times now. But the pitties that I know, definitely, I feel like they know when they're being funny. Especially like, you know, when we're doing agility training and stuff, like once they get people laughing, oh my goodness, are they off and continuing on their shenanigans.
So...
Yeah, they bring a lot of joy into life. And then as far as keeping in mind with training, they are a very like physical breed. So I do use a lot of movement either with toys or with personal play or with the way that I deliver food. So they have a lot of outlets to put all of those like big feelings in productive places.
Cool. Yeah, that's great. I totally agree about the tactile piece. Yes. I think I love helping give pitties like physical affection, but being mindful of people tend to want to like thump these guys really hard because they're like a big, blocky, strong dog. And I feel like a lot of them don't actually love that all the time, but those sort of like deep massages or pets, mm-hmm. they love. So tactile, hands-on sort of attention in the right moments, not if they're super highly aroused, because at that point I'm just going to amp them up more. Mm-hmm. But I do find a lot of them really value that. I'm also really mindful of doing relaxation work with,
yes.
with pitties as well, doing lots of like, let's slow down and learn to slow our heartbeat, because I feel like pit bulls are sort of like, they're sort of like fluctuate between, you know, when you get in the car and it's quiet and you left the radio on way too loud, it's like you turn it on and it's suddenly at like a really high volume. I feel like they're like couch potatoes and asleep, or they're at like level 12 out of 10.
Yep.
You know? And so it takes some work to help them learn to exist at sort of a more medium level of noise some of the time. And we love that excitement as well. And yeah. you need to give them outlets for it. But like that middle ground, I feel like is important to help them with.
Yeah. And also switching between. And I think yes. like being able to like go up and get really excited and come back down and go mm-hmm. up and get really excited and come back down. I find that's really important for them. I just wanted to add, I agree with everything on the tactile side. I also feel like one of the reasons why I love pitties, especially if you're training recall or things that involve movement, like that sort of shoving behavior, like mm-hmm. into their chest. So if they come to you, you can kind of like shove them backwards and then move back.
The pushing back and forth. Yeah.
The pushing back and forth. And I find they're really into that. And so I would agree with you, not as much about the thumping, but like the deep massages and also like kind of like that pushing.
Giving them a chance to push back against yes. your sort of hands placed on them. I feel like they really love.
Yeah, absolutely.
And again, dog dependent. And you have to sort of start small with that and make them feel like, yes, this is a friendly yeah. encounter that we're having.
Yeah.
But yes.
And I'll also say, because I know I've talked about this, you know, I've been in this field for 15 years, but I was bit as a kid and was nervous of dogs growing up. And it wasn't until, you know, you got me volunteering. And I honestly feel like it was pitties who really made me love dogs. And I'll never forget like learning to get comfortable with them and just like that big blocky head and that big giant smile right in your face. And I'm not recommending you go face cuddle dogs, but there's just something very special about that. And I know for me, I have that connection with them because I don't know if I would be doing this for a living if we didn't have that experience. And also having Buster, like our first, you know, dog, we had it through instinct. And I just feel like they're really special for me, you know, for that reason.
Good stuff. Okay. So moving on from pit bulls, let's switch gears a little bit and talk about huskies.
Yay.
All right. So when you see a husky on the docket, what do you anticipate might be the behavior and training issues that they're coming in with? Brian, you want to start?
Sure. Separation. Well, I was going to say separation anxiety, or it could just be like issues with confinement. I don't know how much it's related to the actual caretaker, which, you know, or the relationship, but just like being confined is very hard for them. And so that's definitely one, is how do we leave them home alone appropriately, I think is probably number one. If you get a husky, they're probably going to pull pretty hard on a leash as well. They can be leash trained, but you're signing up for that if you're getting a husky. So I definitely feel like leash pulling for them is definitely there. I would say like those are probably, oh, and the third one, kind of the same thing with the German Shepherd. They can also be a little loud.
A little.
Yeah, very loud. They can have a lot to say. And they're going to say it. And, Yeah, but I would say, like, for me, like, those the confinement issue is definitely one that comes up, like, over and over and over again, for sure. And I would say, like, leash pulling is the other one.
Cool. Dresden, how about you?
Yeah, I think hand in hand with the confinement issues are the coming when called issues are, you know, right up there. People have trouble keeping them in the backyard, even if it's a very nice fence, and then they have trouble getting them back when they get away. So finding appropriate ways to work on those skills. And then I have had to pull on all of my creative resources with huskies to find, you know, leashes that will stay on. I have seen some of the most interesting and creative evasive maneuvers from some of my husky clients where I was like, I don't even understand how you unclipped that by just doing a backflip, but here you are and there you are. So, like, working on a double leash system and finding some safeties that have definitely, they've been challenges that no other breed has given me. So, yeah.
That's so funny. I love that. Suze, how about you? What issues are you expecting with a husky?
I totally agree. Almost always there's a negotiation that needs to occur in terms of being on a leash and appropriately on a leash. So I feel like they just meet the world full on. So nothing is a given with them. And they love to talk about everything, which I personally enjoy, but they can be loud. So I tend to look at, you know, are they able to settle? Are they able to stay mindful of their handler when they're on leash? Things like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the only one I would add there that I do find I see if a husky's coming in for behavior help. So again, always caveating with that is I do find that some huskies can have some handling issues. They can be sensitive, not unlike a Shiba, except that the husky will tell you the whole time that they're not happy about something, where the Shiba's real quiet about it. Like, the husky's really obvious about their feelings, but I feel like they can also, as much as they can love physical attention when they love it, they can also be, I think, more sensitive to certain types of handling and grooming and whatnot. So sometimes I do think we see dogs come in with some handling issues and maybe snappy, bitey stuff related to that. Some huskies come in. I think that's the only one I would add, but fully agree with the confinement, the ongoing sort of confinement issues and leash pulling, certainly, and lack of responsiveness versus some other breeds. So what do we love about them? These are up there with Shibas as one of my favorite breeds ever. Yeah. And I don't think I'll personally ever own one because my own, truthfully, like, energy level doesn't match what I would need to give them for them to be a happy dog. But wow, I love when they come in, and I'm always one of the first ones to be like, do you need help with so-and-so if someone's working a husky, just so that I have the opportunity to, they're like, no, I'm good. Are you sure? Because they're just like, there's something magic about a husky.
Yeah, they're majestic.
And they're just, it's like a connection you get to have. It almost feels like you're getting this secret little connection with a dog who's like just a little bit more than a dog. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean that in a bad, dogs are enough as they are, but I find something really magical about them that's not very clearly stated. But I love their body language and the way that they kind of curl in and engage in play and how expressive they are about certain things. Like, it's a really special experience to connect with a husky. And I would say they also don't assume competence.
Yeah.
With humans.
Yeah. And like that haunting howl that they do is, and they're more likely to do it, I find, than other breeds as well. But that just, it makes the hair stand up on the back of my neck for sure. Mm-hmm. God, we see it in New York City sometimes because they howl back at the fire trucks or the ambulances, because you'll have like a husky and you're going out on a walk and the fire truck will go by and they'll just start howling and everyone turns and looks at them and they're usually smiling and laughing. It's not like a nuisance thing. I think most people like that, but I do love that as well.
Mm-hmm, definitely. I think, like Shibas and like you mentioned, Suze, with huskies, I'm really mindful about not doing repetitive stuff when we're doing skills training. It's like, let's show you what this is and how to do it. And let's be really mindful and judicious about when and how we use those skills. So I feel like they're typically not a breed who finds the act of, you know, sitting 12 times, especially rewarding. So certainly that, I think using movement and giving them the opportunity to engage in some like chase type behaviors, like things like a flirt pole sometimes can be really helpful for a husky, depending on their motivation to like chase and grab little fluffy things. And again, tactile in the right way. I feel like having the opportunity for them to invite and initiate contact with you can be really, really rewarding. I find like I'm mindful about not just reaching into their space to pet them.
Yeah.
Which some dogs are really happy about, and generally a good idea not to do that with any breed, but I feel like they can be more sensitive to it, but can love the opportunity to be invited in for like pets and cuddles. Mm-hmm. Anyone else have other thoughts on what we love about Huskies? Dresden?
Well, I find that they are like, you know, training them, it is very, you know, conversational. There is a lot of back and forth. And when one is training a Husky, you definitely want to make sure that the function is there of like, hey, I'm asking you to do this so we can do this. And they're not just going to do it because you've asked. Very rarely is that enough of a motivator for them. But I love that you kind of do have to, you know, earn your way into that, you know, their little trust circle of, are you someone that is worth listening to? Do you have good advice? And also, I love how over the top they are with their, you know, place, their play is very exaggerated, is what I'm trying to say. Mm-hmm. I love that, because again, it's silly, and they, you know, display their emotions so well when you are invited into that circle. And, you know, nothing beats getting to watch a Husky like really book it when you get the chance, like rent a field with them and just watch them go. You could tell it just feels so good to them, and they're having a great time, and everything about them just exudes joy.
I love that. Yeah. Suze, do you have additional thoughts to add about Huskies?
No, just really agree with everything y'all have said. And I've learned to really enjoy sort of that zany sense of humor they have.
Okay, so last one that we're going to review today, and I could do this for days.
Yeah, we might need a part two.
We might need a part two. So if you're disappointed that your breed wasn't included, certainly shoot us a note and say, like, complain so that we can justify doing part two. But last on the list that we're going to talk about today is Chihuahuas. Chihuahuas can get a bad rap, right? But also are, I think, very loved and super popular. And we do have the privilege to work with quite a few of them at Instinct. And I'm putting this out there right at the beginning that I love a Chihuahua.
Yep.
I think they're also a breed that I feel like I've said this all day. Maybe this is why I picked this list of breeds, right? But I could so own a Chihuahua. Before we get into all the reasons that we love them, or that I love them, I guess, let's start with what types of issues might we be expecting to see, behavior or training issues, if someone comes in and you just see Chihuahua as the breed? Who wants to kick this one off? Have any?
I'd love to, since I accidentally found myself with a Chihuahua who I adored. And I say this with love in my heart. When I see a Chihuahua coming in, I'm like, okay, who are they biting? Because for a variety of reasons, most of which, by the way, are fair, a lot of Chihuahuas I've seen go straight to a bite. And you know, we could get into an hour good discussion about, you know, why does that happen? You know, do they feel heard? All that kind of stuff. But I do see that biting other dogs, people, whatever, not with an intent to cause damage, but more as a communication. I see that a lot with Chihuahuas.
Yeah, I feel like there's a lot of handling issues with Chihuahuas, like whether it's like vet visits or grooming or clipping nails or picking up and doing those sorts of things. And I do feel like that goes back to, again, when they're puppies, are they being picked up too much? Are they, you know, being exposed to way too many people handling them in ways that's not fair? I also just sort of feel like with Chihuahuas as well, kind of in terms of that sort of, and I sort of feel like it's like defensive biting almost. It's just like make the hands go away, make this stop. Yeah. So just sort of like that defensive biting that I think, you know, can happen a lot is, I feel like, you know, a lot of times people say Chihuahuas don't, they think they're big or they don't know how big they are. I think Chihuahuas know how big they are. I really do. I think they know they're tiny. I think they know that they are way smaller than other dogs and they can get trampled on. They're way smaller than people. And I really feel for them because I do feel like they know, and we have to be very careful about the dogs that they're getting exposed to, who are they playing with? Same thing with people. How are they interacting with them? Because I do feel like they understand that. And that's not like, I know some people say like they have like a Napoleon complex or whatever. And that always makes me angry. It's like, they're just small and they know how small they are. So if their signs aren't being listened to, all they have left is to use their teeth. And the consequences of being that small and someone trampling on you or doing that, you can get like really hurt. And so I feel a deep empathy for Chihuahuas like that. And I also know what we'll talk about. Like, I've seen so many Chihuahuas that are so resilient and they love people and they love dogs. And I honestly feel like it's generally been owners who have been very careful in that socialization period about how they're exposing them to different things. And it's really, really important to be their advocate for these dogs, because I do feel like there's that safety thing. And I have no idea if they know how big they are, but that's just how it feels to me.
Well, I think it would be reasonable to assume that on sort of a evolutionary perspective, and I know it's a little bit odd because we're talking about artificial selection and a short period of time here, but you'd think there'd be some level of kind of like biological preparedness that would help you in saying, I'm small, you're really big. Yes. The damage you can cause me is quite significant.
Yeah.
You know, that we would be set up, they would be set up just as like, you know, a sentient being to recognize that. I would agree that, like, I think that also the other thing that happens, because I would agree, we do see like snappy, bitey behavior very often. I think also some like fearful behavior quite frequently with Chihuahuas, again, potentially because the world is very big when you're that small. I also think one of the realities when you're that small, and this speaks to, again, environmental and life experience influence, is people don't hear your whispers or you're talking at a normal voice. I'm saying this is like a, you know, people don't hear from a Chihuahua what would be the equivalent of their whispers or their talking at a regular voice. We only listen to them when they shout.
Yep.
Right? We only listen to them when they get really angry, because they're so small that either those signals are really easy to miss, or we just don't take them seriously.
Yep.
At where we might take it a lot more seriously with something like a German Shepherd or a Canna Corso, or like, you know, a larger breed who's a little bit more imposing. Yep. We might be quicker to listen to some of those lower level signals. So I don't know if it's so much that Chihuahuas as a breed are prone to biting, or that Chihuahuas as a breed are prone to have some of their more subtle signals ignored more often than other breeds.
I think it's the latter.
So they resort to biting.
Yep.
Yeah.
I have a lot of small dog thought, but no, like going off of what y'all were just talking about, is it might not always even be so much that their, you know, earlier warning signals are ignored, but if you think about it in context of how small the dog is and how quickly the perceived threat is approaching, they don't have as much time to spend in those, you know, freeze, stare, growl, grumble, you know, zones, whatever you want to call it. So they do need to escalate for their safety much faster.
Yeah. The size of the threat is different to them than it would be for a bigger dog.
Yes.
So the response they have to give is different than what it would be for a bigger dog. I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I see a lot of very clever small dogs compensate by beginning to growl much louder, much earlier. So people almost get offended, you know, like, oh, my dog is growling at me because I passed 6 feet away from them on the sofa. But it's not about you passing 6 feet away on the sofa. It's about all the times that you've come up from behind them and suddenly scooped them up. So they're trying to set their perimeter much earlier so you can hear that they're going, hey, I'm napping, I don't want to be bothered. So that's another thing that I tend to see a lot, is that, you know, when they do growl, people start to just see it as, oh, he doesn't mean it, or, oh, this is nonsense information. Where the dog is really trying to establish a boundary that the person can understand.
I love that. It's like it can appear as them being overreactive, or like, what on earth is your problem? But they just, again, they've had to learn how to communicate louder and sort of earlier in the process.
Yeah.
I love that take on it. I think
me too. That's true. I think it's super accurate.
Yeah. Cool. And then, so what do we love about Chihuahuas? It sounds like we all have a certain affinity or fondness for them. And what do we keep in mind when we're training and working with them?
You know, what I love about them, and Sarah and Brian had met my Chihuahua, Frankie, they have such, in a positive sense, big personalities. And Frankie made me laugh more than almost any dog I've had. And he had a particularly strong personality, which I loved. and I had not had a dog as small as him when I adopted him. What I try to keep in mind when they come in for help is that there can be a disconnect between what the Chihuahua needs from his or her human versus what the human feels a dog that small needs. So I tend to try to really make sure we go into that.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's fair. On a very practical sense, I would say from a training perspective, I'm really mindful of making sure that they're warm enough. Or if we're doing things like teaching downs or working on stays, like, do you have a nice cozy bed? If we're going outside, do you have on a coat or a sweater? Because they just get cold. And I feel like that can really impede them performing certain skills because they're uncomfortable.
Yeah.
So that's on a very practical level. I guess I skip to like, I also just love their, I love when a Chihuahua knows that you're a safe person who listens to them.
Mm-hmm.
They're so social and fun, and they will like curl in and initiate contact with you and little pets, and you do the little, you know, the little wiggly spider fingers at them, and they come in and play. And playing like bitey fingers with a Chihuahua is, we're probably not supposed to do that, but like it's so much fun if you put it on cue and it has a clear start and an end. And yeah, so I think I love the social aspect of them. Like I love how sort of playful they can be. And I also love that truthfully little, like having a little mini hot water bottle who wants to come snuggle up into you if they're doing it from a place where they're calm and comfortable and just want to be close versus I'm scared and you're my only safe haven in the world.
Yeah.
Like I think if you get them to that point where they're just like, I love being close to you and I'm also confident and comfortable in the world. I love that part of them, the snuggle part of them.
And they're so smart. Mm-hmm. I find them super, super intelligent, very highly trainable, especially if you're doing like, you know, traditional training, tricks training, any of those things. I know a lot of, I think sometimes they have a reputation that they're not smart just because I think, again, just sort of how they've been nurtured, I think a lot in our culture, but I find them, I agree with everything you said, but I just find them so intelligent and extremely fun to train. Like they can be so engaged with you and love to learn new things. So I also love that about them.
And I would say a lot of times when we see Chihuahuas who are struggling with responsiveness, I do come back to that physical comfort thing.
I agree.
I do feel like that's a significant component in helping them become more responsive to certain cues as they're like, more so than say a dog with a longer coat who's bigger and just has more body heat. They're like, that floor is really cold.
Yeah.
Like, so at least when I'm learning a skill, can we work with something that's a little bit warmer and more comfy and maybe build up? So I feel like that's an ongoing thing that I see is just like, are they physically comfortable?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm definitely mindful of that. Dresden, do you have other thoughts about, and Dresden is, I guess we should have both said at the outset. So Suze is, if we're talking about personal breeds, Suze, you're a Dobie girl. And Dresden, you have Papillon. So I loved how you chimed in and said you have lots of small dog thoughts. So I'd love to hear your take on Chihuahuas, like what you love about them and what you're mindful of when you're training them.
Yeah. So like you said, I have Papillons, which are, you know, essentially the French cousin of the Chihuahua. But I think small dogs are so underrated. You know, you can meet all of their physical needs in an apartment. They are so happy on just like being, you know, down here in Texas, I call my Papillons like, you know, my little truck buddy, where like they're so happy to, you know, pop in the car and see where we go. And okay, we're sitting in a cafe. Awesome. Can I just curl up at your feet? Okay, we're going for a little hike. And like, you know, these dogs can still, they can get their steps in. They're not slouches. So they like to go on little hikes and they can do everything a big dog can do. They're just such like, you know, they're an accessible little breed. They're an accessible little dog. It's so much easier to get everything that you need to do to make them feel really, really fulfilled. Even if you have a small space or a small, you know, network that you're working in.
Yeah.
But no, I find that they are extremely trainable, but I do love what you said about, you know, when you are a trusted person, because again, if we go back and think about some of their, you know, personal space, you know, issues, if that's what they're perceived as, where their requests or needs have been denied over and over and over again, and then we kind of have the audacity to be like, you should be listening to me when I'm asking you these things. Of course the dog is like, excuse me, for, you know, what reason do I have, what have you, where have you met me halfway on anything? So I do think that that is something that people really need to keep in mind when working with small dogs, is that they often don't feel like they have a lot of agency. So they, you know, they get scooped up, they get moved around, their growls get ignored. So making sure you set that foundation of trust and guidance and comfort goes so far as to, you know, just make a whole world of difference.
Yeah.
And I think on that point, just, I would agree with you. I think for any sort of small breed dog, like knowing they are still dogs, they can and do enjoy doing lots of things that a bigger dog would enjoy doing. Just add with the caveat that because they're so transportable, sometimes they do get taken everywhere or taken to lots of places when maybe that's not actually what they want. So I think it's really important to look at the individual dog in front of you and say, is this an experience that they like? Should I be bringing them just because they're easy to take along? And if they do, it's awesome because they're so easy to take along, you know? So like, it's so easy to include them in things if they enjoy it. So I think that can be like a plus and a minus. So I love that. Thank you so much. Oh, so,
just one more thing. I do love that, you know, toy dogs really are, like, because we have selected them for this, like a lot of the times they, like my one Papillon, Ivy, she just wants to be in my lap and would love to just stare into my eyes for hours. You know, that's like, that's where she would love to be, just next to me, either by my feet or next to me on the sofa, and just to gaze lovingly at each other for, you know, a little while before we move on and do other stuff. And I feel like that's, you know, what a lot of people imagine when they get a dog. And I think sometimes that they overlook the smalls, but, you know, that's her. That's what she would love to do. And I do enjoy that.
Love that. Yeah, that's awesome. So with all of that said, if we wanted to kind of wrap up really as quickly as we can and say, in what ways, because when we hear the word stereotype, generally we're not thinking about something positive, even though there can be positive stereotypes, but those still can be harmful. In what ways are our own personal breed stereotypes helpful? Like as you're in your work as a behavior consultant with everything that we just spoke about, in what ways do we find that it's helpful actually to have these sort of these stereotypes in our work with clients? Brian, you want to start?
Yeah, I think stereotypes can be helpful if they're based on a broad range of experience and sort of with all the caveats that we know that they're individuals and everything. But I do feel like it can be a shortcut for us to sort of identify how we can give them the best life possible, right? Like, so if we know like a Husky likes to run, or they let, or, you know, if a German Shepherd loves to play tug, or like whatever stereotypes that we have, I do think it can be helpful in terms of giving us some shortcuts in terms of, hey, what are some activities that we might want to try? What are some things we have to do with the environment? What are some things we have to do in the relationship to sort of give us a shortcut and sort of have a smaller list of things to choose from to sort of move them forward? So I think that is, and I know it comes in handy quite a bit. Is it always going to be accurate? No, and you have to be aware of that. But I sort of feel like having that shortcut to get to a better place is a way that I sort of tend to use that, knowing that, again, looking at the dog in front of us and everything's going to be there. But I do feel like there are some similarities, both in terms of, again, some of the issues we talked about and how we might want to approach the issue, because I think we've seen like what's motivated that over time, mm-hmm. and how we can get to a place where we can, I think, be accurate and efficient with how we move forward.
Yeah, I think that's well said. I think it's like, it can be a nice shortcut. A stereotype of a breed can be a nice shortcut to say, what might this breed be likely to find reinforcing? What types of scenarios and situations might they be likely to struggle with? And then I think the other thing as well is it can also help us, this is a tricky word, normal, but like, what does their behavior fall in a typical range of what might be considered normal for that breed? Because mm-hmm. what looks like a quote unquote normal level of sort of baseline arousal for a Jack Russell is very different than for like a Newfoundland.
Yes.
And so if we're measuring them all the same, that can put us in a tricky situation. We're saying like, oh my goodness, like your Newfie is, you know, feeling depressed. If you've only had Jack Russells and that's your reference point, you're like, nope, they're fine. They're operating as they should be. So I think that sort of reference point of what would be a normal range of behavior for that given breed can be helpful as well for when dogs might fall outside of it.
Yeah.
So yeah, I would say that's sort of the helpful component for me. Susan Dresden, do you have other thoughts on where they're helpful?
The stereotype can give you some ideas about two things. Maybe how the dog likes to learn, but it, more and more, as I look at this, to me, the stereotype is helpful in knowing what the owner is expecting, right? Why did that human choose that either physical appearance or breed or what have you? They have an expectation built in. And when there's a mismatch between how the dog actually is and the expectation, that can cause a lot of confusion. So that's the way I find stereotypes helpful.
I do really like that it's a, you know, like a shortcut, and I use it that way quite a bit. And I absolutely agree with that kind of falling within normal range. It gives you a good, you know, kind of parameter to look at. And then also I find it really helpful from the consulting side of things, if someone is new to a breed and they're really worried about a behavior, to be able to go, hey, it's okay. This is within the normal range of what I would expect to see from, you know, whatever breed that you have. I find that really helps set people at ease and helps them feel like they're not alone.
Yeah, I love that. I have found that to be a super helpful piece as well, is helping people understand, like, yeah, no, that, you know, that's the behaviors that we're seeing are something that we might expect to see from an Australian Shepherd. And here's what we do about it and how we help them based on who they are as an individual, but also as a breed. So I love that. So on the flip side, this is a big question, but we're going to get through it as quickly as we can. You know, in what ways are breed stereotypes harmful on a macro level, but then also kind of on a micro level? I think macro, we can all think about things like breed-specific legislation and all the harm that it does and how wildly inefficient it is at actually limiting public or aiding public safety, mm-hmm. you know, because it's just these broad sweeping generalizations about behavior that are often inaccurate at best. So, I mean, that's a big one that comes to mind for me on a macro level of breed stereotypes. Are there are the harms of breed stereotypes, but are there other things that come to mind that are really harmful about people walking around with these stereotypes of breeds?
Yeah. I mean, one thing I'll definitely add in, and I feel like I tend to see this a little bit more with like newer trainers or behavior consultants, so not so much the more experienced folks, is like the stereotypes can almost be used to like excuse behavior. So it almost becomes like, oh, well, you have an Australian Shepherd, so they're going to chase and herd and nip kids and kind of like throw their hands up in the air. And it's like, that's what you have. And I sort of feel like I see that. So there's a fine line to walk between like knowing that, hey, yeah, this is typical, but also, hey, there are some things we can do to move forward. So I feel like that can be the case, or sometimes people can just use breed to sort of excuse certain behaviors. And I appreciate that people are trying to use the breed to understand certain behaviors, but I feel like sometimes it can be limiting. The other thing as well is, again, knowing that everyone's an individual, sometimes those shortcuts that we could take can actually be harmful for a particular dog. And that's why you always need to have that lens on of, okay, I have some shortcuts I'm going to do. If we're going to try these, how do we help the owner know when that's not working or that's not appropriate or that's not an activity that they like? Mm-hmm. So I sort of feel like for me, that's where there can be like sort of like limiting or like where they can potentially be harmful.
Yeah. I think stereotypes in general are always going to be most harmful when they're rigid.
Yeah.
Right. Like if they're used as sort of a flexible starting point for making an educated guess about something when it comes to a dog's breed, great. If that stereotype becomes rigid and we refuse to sort of veer off from it when we actually see the individual in front of us, then that can be really harmful. I think what comes to mind for me as well is I think it's also really easy for dog owners to get written off when they share concerns about a dog's behavior that might be quote unquote typical or expected of a certain breed, but they're happening at not a typical intensity and frequency. So someone's like trying to tell their vet or their trainer or their friends, you know, hey, my lab is like really wild about stealing food and eating everything. And they're like, oh, that's just labs. Mm. But, you know, we have seen dogs that it's not just labs, right? Like that dog is not fall within what would be a normal or typical or behaviorally healthy profile. They're really struggling with what almost would be, not to use like a medical word, but like a more compulsive sort of need to seek out and grab food or edible items. And that's just one. I think another one is like, you know, we've had Jack Russells, or someone's like, my Jack Russell really struggles with over arousal, and they've been written off as like, that's just a Jack Russell. Like you got what you got. But if it was a dog who's really struggling with a lot of anxiety issues, and that was where the arousal was coming from. It had nothing to do with the dog's breed.
Yeah. And sort of that one on the, like on the lab, we've seen it where like it was dismissed even by, again, not to throw veterinarians under the bus, but it was even dismissed by veterinarians that, hey, they're just a lab. And then when they pushed more and saw a specialist, there's actually something significantly medical going on. And that's happened more than once.
Yeah.
So I mean, it not only just from like a training perspective, from a health perspective.
Yeah. It can get in the way of a dog actually getting the care or training or support that they need if it's written off as like, oh, that's just a breed behavior.
Yeah.
Sousa Dresden, any other additional thoughts about, you know, the harmful aspect of having these breed stereotypes that we're all walking around with?
I think, you know, in particular, dogs that are stereotyped as snuggly, like doodles and French bulldogs, they're still dogs, they're individuals. And so I think they have to deal a lot more with people rushing in to hug them who they don't even know. I think the stereotype works against them in that setting.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I would say too, kind of on that level, it can make it really hard. It can almost prevent someone from seeing the individual that their dog is. Like if someone's like, oh, I love, you know, Labrador retrievers, and so I'm going to go get a lab, but then they fail to see who their lab actually is because they just have this checkbox of what they're expecting the dog to be. And it can almost put blinders on them. So you lose sight of who your dog actually is as an individual. So I think in that way, they can be harmful as well.
Absolutely. I think you guys all did a beautiful job. I'm sure that we all have cases where we've had a dog that, you know, you read the intake form and you go, okay, yep, that's a doodle. And then you go and start working with the client and you go, whoa, this kind of difficulty with hyperactivity is, or, you know, arousal is common in the breed, but this is way beyond what I would expect. And, you know, almost verbatim, you know, having that same situation of they go to the vet and the vet goes, okay, yeah, but you have a golden doodle. And it takes a little bit more pushing where that's where, you know, keeping good notes and writing it down and having something and, you know, working with a behavior consultant can really help give you that extra framework that you need to get your dog to the point where that they're getting the right help and the right referrals.
Yeah. And I think that can speak to too, just sort of the, what's needed in terms of the complexity of the interaction. You know, like breed stereotypes can be really good at just shutting down curiosity. So if it's something that you're bringing up in a 15-minute veterinarian appointment, it's really hard for the vet to dig in and say, what's really going on?
Yeah.
So you default to that quick sort of stereotype. And that, you know, that could happen with any kind of professional in one of those short interactions. So I think to your point, Dresden, that's where like meeting with a behavior consultant or doing a more in-depth consultation with maybe a vet who has a special interest in behavior can let them peel back some of those layers and see what's really going on. Yeah.
Cool.
Good. Well, this was a super helpful, I think it was a fun episode. I really enjoyed it. And I hope people walk away with like, yes, behavior consultants do have stereotypes of certain breeds. We have certain things that we kind of tend to expect to see if a dog is going to present certain issues. We have things that we tend to love in terms of character traits and personalities of certain breeds. But we also are very adamant about always remembering that every single dog is an individual. Stereotypes are a starting point at best to go from, and we need to be prepared to depart from them pretty darn quickly. But I hope if for the breeds that we discussed today, it reflected some of what you see with your own dog. And yeah, we may have to do a part two.
Yeah. All right.
All right. Thanks so much, everyone.
See you next time.
Bye.